crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host for today, Christopher Eames, and I'm coming to you from our beautiful, peaceful radio studio here in Warwickshire, England. That's more than can be said for your regular host, Brent Nagtigale, who is currently enduring a cacophony of jackhammer noises at her office in Jerusalem, hence me doing the program here from England today. Well, things have been quieting down lately, it seems, on the Temple Mount, with the Temple Mount crisis that was happening over the last few weeks. Obviously, world attention has been shifted to the, shall we say, two-state situation of North Korea and South Korea. The rhetoric that has been ramping up by the North Koreans, America with its rhetoric as well, things are heating up quite a lot in that area. And this does affect the Middle East as well, because, as we know, Iran and North Korea have been in cahoots for a long time. Essentially, whatever North Korea develops is liable to get into Iranian hands and just exacerbate the problem even further. So a lot to watch on the news for North Korea, but for today's program, we'll be covering an archaeological subject today, similar to last week. We'll be looking at the life of King David. Now, last week we covered the story of the prophet Elisha. If you've been keeping up with Watch Jerusalem lately, you will remember we started off with the series of the Bible's buried cities, looking at various cities that have been excavated in Israel, talked about in the Bible, and proven through archaeology. And now we look at the people, various figures in the Bible, who have been proven through archaeology. I forget to mention as well, we also looked at the civilizations throughout the Middle East that have been described in the Bible. We did a series on that as well. So now we are looking at the people, and we've done an article on King Hezekiah, the prophet Jeremiah. Last week, like I say, we did the prophet Elisha. And so for today, we are going to look at King David. And this will be also featured in a lengthy article coming out, should be in the next day or two, on Watch Jerusalem. So this program will be looking at this article that I've put together on King David and examining some of the incredible artifacts that I've discovered that really expand the story and validate the biblical story of King David. It's amazing what archaeology has been turning up lately. Just the wealth, the treasure trove of information that's being discovered. If you've been to the site again lately, you may have seen my article on the British Museum and the Bible. I talk about the subject as well in this article. Just the wealth of archaeological finds that have been discovered and that are freely available to see in museums around the world. Just last week, I think it was, I went to the British Museum with a lot of young campers, and we had a tour around the museum. And before we did that tour, we got together and discussed some of the more significant artifacts in the British Museum. It's really easy in a massive museum like that to waste a lot of time, really, on trying to look for the really impressive artifacts in there. And so we put together a list of some of the most impressive biblical artifacts in that museum. And so that list has been reproduced for the website. You can find it there. If you're not able to go to the British Museum in person, then hopefully that'll be somewhat of a virtual tour for you. And that article is filled out with pictures from the museum. Likewise for this article on King David as well. Some of these pictures really help illustrate the Bible stories and add clarity and color to what is being found through archaeology, validating the Bible story. Now, if you asked people as little as maybe 20 or 30 years ago what has been found proving King David's existence, the answer would be nothing. Now, various things dating to King David's time and helping to get a better understanding of his kingdom and that he ruled over during his time, well, yes, certain things have been found. But in terms of the man himself, in terms of a name, nothing had yet been found. And so the scientific community had developed the idea that David couldn't have existed. He was a mythical king. Or if he had existed, then he must have been just some kind of weak, kind of tribal leader, small-time leader, nothing significant at all, and nothing certainly based on what the Bible describes of this king. Well, that all changed in 1993 when the Tel Dan Stela was found. This was a victory stone, a broken victory stone, belonging to the king of Syria. And it was found in secondary use as part of an ancient wall. And the stone, in its original use, would have been to celebrate the victories of the king of Syria, King Hazael, who we know from the Bible, and who we know from archaeology. He's been proven through archaeology. Now, this stone dates to the 9th century BC, and it reads the following passage, quote, "And I killed two powerful kings who harnessed 2,000 chariots and 2,000 horsemen. I killed Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, the king of Joram, king of the house of David. And I set," and the stone continues on. So, in itself, this is a really interesting passage because it talks about King Hazael's battle against the king of Israel and the king of Judah. And we know the story from the Bible. We know these two men were killed from the Bible, as is talked about on the Stela. But what is really interesting in terms of this article is the mention of the house of David. This was the very first time King David's name has been found on an archaeological artifact. And it's not just a passing reference to David the man. It shows that he had a house, a kingly line that was established. This wasn't some random Joe down the road. This was someone famous who had existed, and a kingly line, a house, was built from his lineage, from his genealogical lineage. Now, the Bible uses the phrase House of David about 26 times, so this is a common phrase throughout the Bible, and now it had been found in this archaeological inscription. Now, of course, the inscription would come under intense scrutiny. Bible detractors weren't going to accept as authentic an artifact bearing the name of King David that easily. But after much examination, questioning, re-questioning, the Tel Dan Stela has been accepted as a genuine piece, turned up by genuine scientific excavation. And while it's the most certain of all the references to King David in archaeology, there are two other inscriptions. Now, these other two have been translated with very near certainty to refer to David. We don't need them to have 100% certainty because we already have this Tel Dan Stela. But these other two artifacts do help to add to the building body of evidence. Now, the first of those other two finds was the Misha Stela. Now, we've gone in detail on this program, I think, quite a while ago, about the Misha Stela, more in terms of the rest of the story on the Stela and how it directly parallels the biblical account of King Misha of Moab and how he went up against the Israelites. It has a great many references to things we find in the Bible. But what's interesting for today's program is at the end of the, toward the end of the Mishnah Stela, we have a reference to exactly the same term, House of David, except due to some damage, the initial D, the first D for the name David is missing. So we have House of David missing that initial D. Yet, according to the epigrapher and philologist that that examined this, André Lemaire, he believes that reading anything other than David would be an awkward fit in this case, and it certainly seems like it. And this, seeing as this Mishnah Stela dates not too far away from the Tel Dan Stela, it would make quite a lot of sense for both of them to be referring to exactly the same thing, House of David, especially seeing as both artifacts deal in direct connection with the Kingdom of Judah. And then the final inscription piece is an Egyptian inscription, and this dates around the end of the 10th century BC. So if this one does indeed refer to King David, it is the earliest inscription that refers to him. It was translated by a leading Egyptologist, Kenneth Kitchen, and the hieroglyphics, the Egyptian hieroglyphics, were translated to read the Heights of David, or Highlands of David, referring to a section of the Negev Desert. So there's no problem with the first word, Heights or Highlands, but the issue was with the word David, because this one had a different letter at the end. It ended with a T sound rather than a D sound, so it came across more as Heights of David rather than Heights of David. Now, at first, Kenneth Kitchen was trying to work this out. What would this mean? There are no parallels to David. It would seem that this has to refer to David, but why with a T? Well, he did find a 6th century AD inscription from Ethiopia, which referred to David as David, with a T on the end. So we have, for this general region at least, some precedent for pronouncing David in this way. And obviously with the Egyptians, you've got a different language there. You're bound to have a different pronunciation of the name. So it certainly seems almost certain that this is referring to David, the Heights of David. And it makes even more sense because we know that while David was on the run from Saul, that took place in the Negev Desert, and he certainly held a lot of territory within the Negev Desert, was very powerful in this area. So it would be natural for the Egyptians to refer to this area of the Negev as being the Heights or Highlands of David. Okay, so those are the three inscriptions, the three main inscriptions relating to King David. Obviously, the Tel Dan Stela is the certain one, and then the Mishnah Stela and Negev inscription are the two probable references to him. So as I go through this article, I start out from King David's beginnings as a shepherd and go right through his story. So we won't have time for that for today's program, but we'll pick out some highlights. Obviously, for David's life, he started out, as I say, as a shepherd within the hills of Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is a town that has been excavated somewhat and discovered somewhat through archaeology. And during his time in those highlands, we know from the story that David was a brave man. He was a musical man. And he was able to defend his flock that he was guarding from both a bear and a lion. Now, we covered this briefly on last week's program, but some people wonder, what are a bear and a lion doing in Israel? Well, in actual fact, bears still do live in this general area of the Levant. One was seen in the wild, actually, not too long ago in Lebanon. They're believed to be extinct, though, currently in Israel and also in Syria. So that's the Syrian brown bear is the species. And just to add colour to the story of King David, while these bears are the smallest bear in the brown bear family, they still do grow up to about 550 pounds in weight. So a really impressive, domineering sight is what these bears would have been. So certainly a brave teenager to defend his flock from a beast like this. And then obviously there's the lion as well. And these were known to live throughout the Middle East, including Israel. And they were they're believed to have gone extinct in Israel around the time of the Crusades, maybe about the 1200s AD. But we're not too sure about that. Now, David, as we know from the story, was crowned king, or not so much crowned king, as anointed king by the prophet Samuel to begin with. It would be some time before all of Judah, and then subsequently all of Israel, would accept him as their king. But to begin with, based on Saul's failing record, on Saul's rebellion against God, Samuel was sent and he anointed David as king. Now Saul at this stage, King Saul, was entering quite a depressed time of life, even a possessed time of life. And as such, David, who was already quite a well-known, recognized harpist in the area, was called into the royal courts to help soothe the king through harp music. Now, it's interesting, even with regards to pulling out little archaeological nuggets from these stories, the harp was actually around for perhaps even 2,000 years before David. It's been discovered through archaeology, through depictions and carvings, that the harp must have been around 2,000 years before David. So by the time of King David, it must have been a really well-honed instrument. And so, obviously, it's not unusual that someone during this time period would be quite skilled at playing the harp. So that's what David did in King Saul's courts. After some time, though, David was released from the employ of Saul and would soon meet the king again due to some very large problems. Now, referring to large problems, obviously, I'm talking about the Philistine Goliath. So we'll pick that up in a little bit, but for now we'll take a break.
This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm.
Jerusalem. The name means city of peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Christopher Eames, and we are going through the story of King David. This is coming out soon on our Watch Jerusalem website as a new lengthy article describing his life and the wealth of archaeological attestation to him, artifacts that have been found dating to his time period, really filling out his story. And we ended the first segment right at the time when David is coming up to fight against the Philistines. At this time period, we have Goliath on the scene, very well known, obviously, children's stories, and many of us have been brought up with those stories, like Goliath. And there is a lot of archaeological evidence for what happened here between the Israelites and the Philistines. Now, the Philistines at this point in time were causing many problems for Israel at the end of the 11th century BC. And at this point in the story, the Philistine armies had invaded Judah and gathered themselves together near the Valley of Elah. Now, the king of Israel, King Saul, wasn't about to let the Philistines have free reign, free entry into Israel. So he took out his troops to make a stand against the Philistines. And we know from the Bible story that basically the Philistines have their camp, the Israelites have their camp, and periodically this giant Goliath would walk out between them in the Valley of Elah and would declare these blasphemous tirades against the Israelites and would challenge them to a one-on-one duel with him in order to decide the victor between the two armies. Now, while no remains of this giant Goliath have yet been found, something can at least be said for his name. Goliath was from Gath, that was his hometown. This city site has been identified through archaeology. We'll talk more about that in a bit. And along with that have been found two inscribed names on pottery dating to around this time period. And they bear a similar linguistic link to the name Goliath. I'm not sure if I can pronounce them properly here, but the two names are Alwat and Wallet. And you have to remember Goliath is an anglicized version of the Hebrew Galiat. So we have Galiat as Goliath, and we have these two similar sounding names, Alwat and Wallet. Now, all three of them, show Indo-European roots rather than Semitic roots. So we can see a similar theme here that the name Goliath does fit into the type of people who would be living in the city of Gath. Now this does make sense as well that they be Indo-European roots because we know that the Philistines must have come from a Mediterranean origin originally. Now, David had many brothers who were encamped against the Philistines in the army, and his father Jesse sent David out to the camp in order to bring supplies to his brothers. Now, a fortress where the Israelites were likely stationed themselves has been found, and that's known today as Kibbutz Kayafa. Now, this is a big circular fort, which has been dated to the time of King Saul and King David. It essentially ends its use at the time of King David, which is quite interesting. That's another story. You can look that up. We've actually written an entire article on Kibbutz Kayafa on our website, Watch Jerusalem. But this was a somewhat circular, large fortress, and it could possibly be the same fortress referred to in the Bible as being in the area known as Sha'arim. Now, Sha'arim means two gates, and what was interesting about Kibbutz Kayafa is that it had two massive gates in it. Now, this is unusual because the gates are a weak point of the city, and so you want to limit the amount of gates on it. So it's not known why Kibbutz Kayafa had two gates, but it certainly does match up with the known biblical fortress that was in that same area, known as Sha'arim. So this could have been the same Sha'arim. Also, the word trench that is used in 1 Samuel 17, verse 20, it talks about the Israelite soldiers being set up in a trench. This word actually can be translated as circular rampart, and this certainly looks very much like Kibbutz Kayafa today. It's a big circular rampart fortress. So this could very well have been that fortress. And again, it does date to this time period. So seeing, obviously, the Israelite men fearfully cowering from the tirades of Goliath, David marched up to King Saul and demanded to be allowed to go and fight the Philistine. Saul was, of course, initially hesitant, but then finally conceded to the young man. And David went out and slew the Philistine giant Goliath with a sling stone. Again, like the harp that we talked about earlier in the program, we can take another little archaeological nugget out of this. Now, the sling stones and slings had been quite common of a weapon for thousands of years before David's time. So this is a very common instrument, especially for a shepherd. Someone in David's case, it could be very easily pocketed. It was a cheap weapon. And so would just make sense for David to be carrying and be expert in a weapon like this. And what's really impressive about sling stones, some people may wonder, well, this was a big armored giant, and how could a little sling stone bring him down? What's really impressive with the slings, even going back to ancient times, was that when used with the right ammunition, a sling stone can actually travel faster than an arrow, with greater range, with greater accuracy, and with greater impact force. So it was actually a really powerful weapon, the sling. And they can even be fatal when the victim is wearing armor. There was a Spanish man who was present during, I forget exactly what it was, a Spanish invasion into the Americas, an ancient Spanish invasion, and they came across Peruvian men who were using slings, and he actually wrote that the sling stones coming out of these Peruvian slings would actually hit the Spaniards so hard that it would break their swords in half. That was the power that could be wielded through slings. So David obviously would have had a lot of practice with his sling out in the countryside, and he would have used it to great effect here. It's often seen as the poor man's weapon, but again, one of great effect. So the Philistines, seeing that their champion was dead, fled from the battle. Naturally, the Israelites celebrated this victory, but King Saul, as we know, soon became jealous of King David and feared that this was the man who was going to overthrow him, who was prophesied to overthrow him. And so, of course, this led to Saul's attempts to kill David, and David went on the run from Saul. Now, partway through his time on the run, David took refuge in the Philistine city of Gath. Like I mentioned, this city has been discovered through archaeology. Again, this was a city of giants. Goliath lived here. And the city certainly could have accommodated giants. Looking at it archaeologically, it had about the biggest gate structure that had been found in the entire region for that period. So a really big city, big gate structure. Even David is featured alongside this gate. When he entered the city of Gath, people started recognizing who he was, and so he feared for his life to the point of feigning madness. He started drooling and clawing at the city gate of Gath, and as a result, he was swiftly ejected from Gath. And so it's just interesting to think that with this gate that has been discovered, perhaps this was the very gate structure on which David basically pretended to be a madman. Another point about the city of Gath is that David did eventually befriend the king of Gath. He was called King Achish. And in the Philistine city of Ekron, a large inscription was found listing a number of Philistine kings. And one of the kings on that list, probably not the same man, but a later king of the same name, he was called Achish. So this is an interesting link between this common name that was used. And like the names Goliath or Goliath, Alawat and Wallet, the name Achish is not a Semitic name. So an interesting link up there with the story as well. So, as we've already briefly covered, David spent much time in the Negev region on the run from King Saul. And again, this would make sense linking to the Negev inscription, Heights of David, referring to that portion of the Negev. That would make a lot of sense based on how much time he spent in the Negev. Now, finally, Saul ended up dying during a battle with the Philistines, and King David honorably mourned the death of King Saul and was now recognized by the tribe of Judah as their new king. Yet the rest of Israel followed a son of Saul named Ishbosheth. This man is also known in the Bible by his name Ishbaal. Now, this name also is interesting because it has been found in Kirbet Kayafa, that same city we were discussing earlier, the name Ishbaal on a pottery piece. Now, this may or may not have been the same Ishbaal, but what is interesting about this name is that names with the term Baal in it, obviously referring to a pagan god, generally fall out of use after David's time. So finding the name Ishbaal and finding it referencing the period of David's time matches up directly with the Bible, because in the Bible, around this period, around King David's time, you have people being called names with the term Baal in them, like Ishbaal. And afterwards, you find these names dropping out of use. So archaeology shows the same thing. It shows names like this being discovered, dating to this time period, and then dropping out of use. So that's just one of the many things that can be pointed to when people say, well, the Bible was written long time after the fact, when actually, in fact, even the specific names match up to the periods with which they belong, with which they were written. So it helps show a lot of archaeological and historical context in the Bible. So the name Ishbaal, discovered at Kirbet Kayafa. Now, Ishbaal's reign only lasted a couple of years. A long, drawn-out war took place between the House of David, there's that term again, and the House of Saul during this time. Ishbaal was eventually murdered by two of his captains, and as a mark of justice, King David executed the murderers. And so, not in small part to this act, all of Israel started to rally behind King David, and he was made king of all of Israel. Now, there's a lot more that goes into the story. We've only just arrived at the part of the story where David becomes king over all Israel. There's a lot more to his story, and so I'd encourage you, as we come to the end of this program here, to look up the story as it comes out, perhaps today or tomorrow, on Watch Jerusalem, and just to see all of these different archaeological features, evidences come out to support the story of King David. It truly is amazing to see the wealth of archaeological information that is there. Obviously, with the story of King David, there's much that has been found in Hebron, the original place of his rule, then Jerusalem, the secondary place of his rule. There's a little bit there on the discovery of King David's palace in Jerusalem. There is discoveries such as in Gezer of the Philistine presence there, and the Bible talks about that battle there with the Philistines in Gezer by King David. And there's also the name of a few priests, Yakim, Hetzer, and Maaziah, who have been found through archaeology. It's not for certain that these are the same priests that King David ordained to their roles, but there is a chance that these were the same priests based on the ancient nature of the inscriptions. So there's a lot more that goes into David's story, a lot more archaeology, and unlike people were saying 20, 30 years ago, this isn't just a story of a mythical king. This isn't largely a false story with the odd, perhaps, correct name or correct city. This is a story that is really being filled out through archaeology, and it's the same with our other individuals we've covered. King Hezekiah, Prophet Elisha, and the prophet Jeremiah. these stories are being filled out by archaeology, and it's amazing to see that attestation, the evidence that is coming to light, and there'll only be more of it, we can be sure of that. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening, and please join us next week. It'll probably be your regular host again, Brent Nagtegale. We'll see how those renovations happen. Hopefully there won't be so much noise as there has been today. But until then, thanks very much for listening, and have a great week.